Here we are, January 2nd. How many New Year's resolutions have we already bombed out on? You know, making New Year's resolutions is a universal impulse. Even if you didn't make any this year or haven't in a number of years, the idea of taking another crack at an important improvement, self-improvement, associated with turning the page on a new year possesses a profound appeal to the human spirit. With a new year, we get a fresh start in a certain way that seems psychologically real and actual. And it is real, isn't it? It's a new day. Every day is a new chance. And that's why today is the first day of the rest of your life, is one of the perennial inspirational posters. Segments of time give us the chance to start at a point again and climb the mountain once more. And yet, how difficult making important improvements can be, especially later in life, for those of us who seem like we are definitely later in life, when our preferences have become more deeply cut due to so many previous New Year's with all the confirmations and habits and preferences that we tend to establish over the long haul. A new resolution is very often really a version of an older effort, and in any event, one can scarcely imagine any important new resolution that is not connected to the large challenges that we have faced in many guises and ways throughout our life in our quest for a more satisfying life, a more effective life, a more successful life. There's a reason why people joke about how long they will be able to last in a New Year's resolution, or people will joke about how long they think somebody else whom they know well will last in their stated New Year's resolution. Because previous experience sometimes presents evidence that it's going to be very tough going quickly, that we or they are up against some cagey and wily opponent who has an impressive one-loss record against us. Sometimes with New Year's resolution, there's already been a setback by January 2nd. And that's today. I would like to sustain a reflection for the next several minutes using a metaphor from the realm of sport in the quest for spiritual fitness, if you will. If you're not engaged in sport culture in any way, shape, or form, I promise that I will build a bridge out to any kind of human endeavor. And I do submit that endeavors undertaken for spiritual well-being and fitness is itself universal. Sport as a vehicle for self-improvement, for achieving one's personal best, is a vast phenomenon in our culture. There's something like $85 billion spent overall in sport culture, ranking it, I think, fifth or sixth in the industries of the economy, right behind transportation, if I remember in an article I read. I've been waiting for a Sunday when I could appropriately draw upon either this New Testament reading that Janet just read for us, or another one from a small handful of places in the writings of the Apostle Paul, in which he uses sport as a metaphor. Did you know that in Jesus' day in Palestine, there were two stadiums erected for athletic competitions that were appropriating the Greek Olympic Games that had been spreading all over the Mediterranean basin? One was over in neighboring Philistia, not very far away, right on the coast. You know, that would be the Philistines. And all I need to tell you about the Philistines and their love of fitness training and sport culture is that Goliath was a Philistine. The other stadium was commissioned by none other than Herod the Great, the Pharisee in charge when Jesus was arrested the night right after the Last Supper, which we will engage as part of our spiritual meal today in a little bit. Now, Jesus uses a lot of agricultural metaphors for the spiritual life in the sayings that are captured in the Gospels, but he never uses a sport metaphor. He had to know about the games and the athletic competitions, but he never himself uses a sport metaphor, and that should probably give me pause. However, the most effective apostle in building the early church, Paul, uses sport metaphor several times. Paul was an upper-class Jewish man raised outside of Palestine, up north, Asia Minor, Tarsus, in a much more Hellenized environment. And his education included many features of classical Greek education, such as the gymnasium, which attempted a pedagogy of the whole person, development of the whole being, mind, spirit, and body too. The bodily vision that included a very high understanding of what can be accomplished spiritually in physical education. And there's great evidence that Paul had been a runner. In a number of places, Paul sees an analogy between running a race for a physical goal line and running a race for a spiritual goal line. In very long races, which we call marathons in contemporary culture, simply reaching the finish line is a triumph and a success. Paul declares that finishing a hard race is like keeping faith. Keeping the faith in the going when the going gets tough. Keeping going, keeping one's eye on the prize. The way might be excruciatingly hard, but to persevere is an accomplishment that in the end makes it all worth it and more. The realm of competitive sport presents an intriguing spiritual metaphor in a very particular way for something upon which I want to dwell for a little bit. In sport, and I submit in life, there is inevitably many, many experiences of losing, of getting beaten. In fact, technically, in team sports, there's a loser every time, every single contest. It's built into the design of the endeavor as a necessary outcome for someone. And every experienced athlete knows that losing, when one journeys with the journey long enough, losing can be far, far more important of an experience than winning. Losing can be more instructive and more helpful for the next adventure or endeavor than winning is. And that, beloved, is a very useful perspective to take forward in the spiritual quest. In our Swedenborg reading that was published in the weekly email in the church, and it's printed in our bulletin on the right-hand page, inside page, there's a reading from Swedenborg's Heaven and Hell that describes one of the important metaphysical features of the design of life. I invite you to take this passage from H&H with you this week. Perhaps ponder it a couple of times. It is one of many places where Swedenborg helps us to see that we're placed in a spiritual environment at which we must live at the edge of our capacities every day. We're always living at the edge of our abilities. It's the nature of being finite beings in a vastly infinite arena of life. The pressure upon our souls between higher and lower forces in this matrix that we find in our specific individual points as people in this world is such that the tension creates a space very propitious for learning. In this passage, Swedenborg calls this space a balance. Other places, he calls it a freedom. In physics, when you put, and Swedenborg himself used this analogy, when you put two forces together directly opposite each other with precisely equal intensity, the space in the exact middle between those two forces in physics is called a state of perfect rest. Our souls abide in just such a balance of pressure between the higher and the lower, gauged at the right level for our capacity to be living at the edge of our abilities for improving ourselves or succumbing to the force that would take us under. What this means is that things are very likely proceeding as they should when we are getting knocked down about as much as we are experiencing successes. Things are going well when we are winning about half the time. For the longest time in my life, I thought that spiritual attainment would be when I had finally mastered the art of living successfully in all aspects of life every day. That I have become so competent in how to move with the patterns and challenges of life that I could meet everything successfully and be on top of life. But that kind of spiritual vision, I believe, is misinformed. Study the lives of the great spiritual biographies, the great spiritual figures about whom we read over and over again in history. And it will become clear that, in fact, spiritual formation is not a matter of getting on top of it all finally through one fantastic weekend spiritual retreat and then coasting to bliss with tremendous empowerment forevermore. The study of great lives, including Swedenborg's, by the way, reveal that struggles continue all the way. But the beauty and the joy is that the place of struggle begins to be transmuted to higher levels, evolves onto higher planes, and one's competencies and capacities are, in fact, becoming enlarged and deepened. But we still live at the edge of our new attainment of capacities and empowerments. There may be still a few around here who remember that when I was pastor here, my office door was covered with religious cartoons. And I also kept a few on the bulletin board in the coffee hour room. And one that got very yellow on my door because I liked it so much is from Charlie Schultz's Peanuts. The one where Linus and Charlie Brown are engaged in a philosophical conversation about the hard knocks of life. And Linus raises his finger in emphasis and says, "Life is rarely all one way, Charlie Brown. You win a few and you lose a few." Charlie goes, "Really?" And in the last panel, his face dissolves into a melancholy smile and says, "Gee, that would be neat." But the Lord has designed us and this place for us to win a few and to lose a few. I play a lot of tennis in competitive leagues. I find it tremendously instructive for the larger game of life. And I suspect that all of our activities, hobbies, our favorite passions are replete with teaching metaphors for the deeper things of living. And I've come to a great appreciation for experiencing life at its best when I'm playing about 500, when I'm winning about half the time and losing about half the time. I consider that good equilibrium tennis, the word that Swedenborg uses in his passage for this space of balance or the freedom within a particular kind of tension where the forces are in an equilibrium. I love to win. Victory is even playing somebody that's not putting in much of a challenge is emotionally satisfying. Why, you just feel good. But there's something about failing that tends to be more riveting in general, that tends to create greater experiences of self-reflection, of noticing one's edge of capacity, of presenting in that the sharpness of that tension more precise information about where one's limitations are and where one's growth points are. Failure gives us the opportunity to identify what's not working well, what's still broken, and hopefully to see precisely why it can be changed or improved, and then doing the actual physical exertion of an attempt to apply a new effort in improving where we are at. If I'm not doing that, I'm not having successful failures in my failures, and I'm stagnating. But if I am having successful failures, then I become a better 500 player in that division. I start winning more than half my games in that division, and I have to go up to another division where I'm losing more than half the time and start the process all over again. And I think this is true for just about everything we do in our lives. You know, there's a writers group meeting this afternoon after coffee hour. One cannot become a better writer without attempting to exceed one's current practice. You have to write several not quite great poems for every pearl. And most pearls are themselves long in formation with failures within the process of that pearl as it is worked towards a piece of art. Most spiritual growth issues in our lives actually revolve around our relationships with other people. That's the biggest drama. It's not playing the stock market. It's not being better at amassing physical accoutrements in life. It's how we are living in community with other human beings. That's the deepest gold. That's the richest harvest. That's where spiritual life manifests in its most powerful ways. And there are important dimensions of our lives that may be very private and individual and just for ourselves. But most of us, if we knew our dreams every night, would see that the great dramas around which our souls wrestle involve those who are in our life in other ways, other people. And this is the hardest game to master in many respects. It takes the full range of our being, that full pedagogy that the Greeks were onto. It takes our whole mind. It takes our heart becoming more flexible, more expansive, less egotistical, more capable to carry burden and sacrifice. It takes our fortitude and our patience, all of which are capacities that usually we must grow in life. It might be hard sometimes to see as clearly as improving your golf drive or craftsmanship in a complicated needlepoint, but how to move with skill and support in human community, in our families, with our coworkers, with our neighbors, can grow just as certainly and just as satisfyingly as the simpler metaphor frames of sport or crafts. The past 50 years in seminaries has seen an enormous shift in who comes to seminary. Before 1970 or so, seminaries were populated nearly entirely by very young adults, often continuing straight from undergraduate studies. But as the ministry started falling as a popular profession path, as a power career in our culture, especially after the 60s, young adults in the 70s and then especially the 80s were not coming into the seminaries like they had been in the same numbers in the decades going all the way back to the revolution in this country. But what emerged was a shift elsewhere in our population for coming to seminary. And this was the second career option for many middle-aged and even older adults, a phenomenon that had not existed except in very small percentages beforehand. My point in sharing this is it's very interesting to see the skills and talents that are developed over time by people who stay in the game of the challenges of human community and the challenges of finding meaningful and significant life in social in a social world that is often full of pain, full of isolation, full of incompetency, society with lots of difficult problems. In the classroom, a lot of the young adults come out of undergrad with tremendous study skills. And for better or worse, fortunately or unfortunately, graduate school is a lot of reading, a lot of information absorption, a lot of analysis of what has been read. And generally speaking, people's capacity for pulling all-nighters and absorbing massive amounts of information to be able to regurgitate back on tests declines over time. The older students are not nearly as good at that, generally speaking, than the ones just out of college. But what has been so impressive is the unfailing high level of wisdom that is generally present in the reflection discussions in classroom. The learnings that have been accrued by staying in the game and working on the life skills that count over decades of time is very apparent. People might think that they're losing steam or they don't have the capacities of youth anymore, or that somehow one is losing something precious as the grains of sand drop through the vessel, but it isn't true. The gold is really being purified in people working hard on their spiritual lives over time. In any event, I think this is the accrual of playing some really engaged 500 ball throughout life. I see people who have won some and who have lost some, but whose failures have in the end been successful. So now to conclude this spiritual reflection on the first Sunday of the new year, I'd like to put forth a couple of assurances from our theology about this, the endeavors that we put ourselves into. And the first is that God never puts us in a match in which we do not belong. We're never in a challenge situation that doesn't link up with playing at our edges and our capacities. It may be that we will finally get something right, or it may be that we're not quite there yet, but we are growing towards a greater possibility of gaining competency in something important, and then have a possibility of a successful failure from that experience. A second assurance in Swedenborgian theology is that God is always on our team. Boy, I know that sounds corny, but God is on our team, and it's a beautiful reality. In sport, God is also with the opponent. It's also with the opponents in the game. And of course, the external outcome is not where the winning and losing in God's mind lies. God is the original win-win architect and knows how to enable all people in a given situation to move in the best learning options they have at their current capacities. So always there is a community of presence in every endeavor. We're not alone in our moving, in our situation. God is always there to extend deeper insight, deeper strength, so that when we consciously ask for it and turn to it, strive to be receptive of it, and honor what comes in a conscientious effort to enact and apply from our team partner. And a third assurance in Swedenborgian theology is that if we choose to play the game in the largest sense of that word, there's no chance, zero chance, of ending up on the losing side. Everyone who opts in on the big game of life wins the kingdom. That's because we are designed with the right equipment to learn when we want to. So we have to want to. If we want to, it's impossible not to gain the kingdom. That's what Paul, the competitive runner, is saying this morning. As for me, I am already being poured a libation. I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. And from now on, there is reserved for me the crown of righteousness. It will be so for all who want it.